approximately 400 years after the Jewish nation had entered Eretz Yisrael, Shaul HaMelech is appointed. The king Shaul is now the ruler, and Shaul HaMelech was a great individual, a tremendous tzaddik. He went in the ways of Hashem, and he brought the Klal Yisrael to great heights. However, as great as Shaul was, he made a mistake, and when he was told to kill out Amalek, he didn't kill Agag, and Hashem sent Shmuel HaNavi a message that Ma'asti B'Shaul, I no longer want Shaul to be the king. He's proven himself to not be a leader for the Klal Yisrael, and he will be replaced. Shortly thereafter, right around this time period, the Plishtim re-attack, and they send out Goliad. Goliad was a giant, a man of phenomenal proportions, huge, and for 40 days he would walk out in front of the Giborim of Yisrael. He would walk into the front line, and he would challenge. Let us not fight with wars. Let us not fight army against army. You send out one of your warriors, I'll fight against him, and that will determine the outcome. For 40 days he walked in front of the Jewish line, challenged the Jewish soldiers, and not a man had the audacity to stand up to Goliad, because the man was huge. His armor was so heavy that and it would crush a normal man, and no one dared take the challenge. In desperation, Shaul offered a tremendous bribe, if you would. He had a daughter, Michal. Whoever kills Goliad will get to marry my daughter. Still, no one would take up the offer. They knew it was suicide. At a certain point, David was not in the army of Shaul, was not a warrior, comes forward and he says to Shaul, I will do it, I will attack. Shaul knew quite well who this David was, and Shaul initially tried to talk him out of it. You're going to die. David says, no, I trust in Hashem. Shaul said, fine, take my armor. I want you to wear my own personal armor when you go to battle. David said, no, the miracle won't be clear enough. And David went out, fought against Goliad without a sword, without armor, with but his slingshot. And in fact, a miracle happened. He killed Goliad with one stone that entered the visor. Goliad fell to his death. Shaul had to keep his word. And in fact, Shaul gave over his daughter Michal to David. And publicly, David was Mekadesh. He did Kedushin, married Michal. Shortly thereafter, the women in the Klal Yisrael began singing praises. Look at Shaul, he's a killer of thousands. Look at David, he's a killer of 10,000s. They began praising David to be greater than Shaul. And the Pasuk tells us that a ruach ra, some type of emotional unrest, settled upon Shaul. It was clear that Hashem wanted to get rid of Shaul as the king. And this ruach ra, this emotional blackness, settled over him, and he began chasing David. He took David to be his enemy, and he chased David. David ran away. At which point, Shaul took Michal, who he had married very shortly before, to David, and gave this woman to Palti ben Laish. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that Palti ben Laish had a tremendous, tremendous nisayon. He understood that this woman, Michal, the daughter of Shaul, was married to David. She's an Ashes Ish, a married woman. On the other hand, he couldn't refuse Shaul, because Shaul, with his Beis Din, said that it was mutter, and the Kedushin weren't a good Kedushin, and Shaul, as king, commanded him to take this woman. Take this woman, he couldn't, she's an Ashes Ish. Not take her, he couldn't, because the king commanded. So in fact, he took her into his tent, and for quite a long time, they were together as man and wife, and the Gemara tells us that not once did he touch her. Ma'asa, what did he do? Na'atz cherev beino lebeino. He took a sword, and into the mattress between him and her, he stuck the sword in, and he said the words, kal osik bedavazeh, who's ever involved in this matter, meaning Arias, Yadakir Becherzeh will be stabbed with this sword. He stuck his sword in the mattress, remained there, and for as long as he remained with Michal under the same roof in the same tent, that sword remained there, and he did not touch her. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Palti Shemo. His name really is Palti, yet he's called Paltiel. Why? Shepalto kel min Avera, because Hashem saved him from Avera. This was considered a miracle of unimaginable proportions. The Gemara tells us, as great as Yosef HaTzadik was, Yosef was chased for almost an entire year by the wife of Potiphar. 3 times a day she would change her clothing. She would wear special perfumes. Everything in her power she did to seduce Yosef. Yosef was but a lad of 17, 18 years of age. And for an entire year she pursued him and did everything in her power to seduce him. And Yosef stood strong. The Gemara tells us that that is nothing compared to what Paltiel ben Loish withstood. He withstood a much harder avera because he was permitted to this woman, at least by Shaul and the Beis Din. He was under the same roof. They were sleeping in the same tent. And for quite a long, long time, he didn't touch her. They remained pure. He is considered far greater than was Yosef. And Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz asks a very penetrating question on this Gemara. And it is as follows. Clearly, Palti understood that this was wrong. He understood that he's forbidden to this woman. He understood that she's an Eishes Ish. So if so, what did he need the sword for? He got it. He realized David was married to this woman. He realized this was a major Nisayan, so he doesn't need the sword. He understands she's Usser, so he doesn't need the sword. But even more, what good did the sword do? He's the one who put the sword down. If one day he becomes overcome with desire, he can also pick the sword up. So question number one is, what does he need the sword for? Question number two is, it doesn't do much good. Yet the Gemara seems to imply that the way he vanquished the Yetzirah, the way he won this war, was by taking the sword and plunging it into the mattress there. And that's how, in fact, he won. And the question is, how does the sword help him? What does this Gemara mean to tell us? And to understand this, I believe we need to focus a little bit on the human being that we are. You ever notice some guys can't stop eating? Cannot stop eating. A guy can be motivated to lose weight, can want to lose weight, but he can't stop eating. He eats and he eats and he eats, and he weighs 400 pounds, and it kills him, and it destroys him, and he cannot control his eating. Yet that guy has no problem fasting on Yom Kippur. Never once will he break a fast. Tuesday, he can't stop his mouth, but the minute Yom Kippur comes, the minute it's Asar B'Tavis, Tisha B'Av, he has no problem fasting. Same thing with a guy smoking. A guy smokes 2 packs of cigarettes a day, cannot prevent himself, can't help himself, literally cannot stop. He used the word addicted. Yet comes Shabbos, no problem. If he doesn't smoke on Yom Tov, he could have a 3-day Yom Tov, and he'll stop for 72 hours, and not once does he break it. And more than that, he could be doing this for 30 years. He could be smoking for 30 years, saying the words, I can't help myself, I can't help myself, I can't help myself, but every single Shabbos, he stops cold turkey. What's pshat? So I'd like to share with you the why. The why really is quite simple. You see, it's forbidden, absolutely forbidden to smoke on Shabbos. It is forbidden to eat on Yom Kippur, 100% out of bounds. And when the human being knows that this activity is utterly, completely forbidden, it's very easy to not do it. The problem is that when you eat all the time. And when you eat all the time, it's permitted. Well, I want you to eat these foods and not that food. I want you to eat at 2 o'clock, but not at 4 o'clock. I want you to stop at this point. You see, it's very easy to have something in the category of forbidden, and it's untouchable, and there's an aura about it. It's something that's beyond bounds, and it's simple enough for most of us to remain away from it. It's when we're involved in it, or if we did it once, if we did it 5 times, or we do it regularly, that's when it's a very real problem. I've often said this, that I'm jealous of the AA programs. Why am I jealous of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or any of the various AA programs? Because most of the people going to these programs recognize one core truth. If I don't stop, I'm going to die. If you've just lost your house, your wife, your job, your kids, if everything has come crashing down around you, you find yourself in the absolute bottom of life, and you recognize that if you don't stop, you're going to die, you're able to get it. You're able to understand it. And you're able to take something that was permitted till then, something that you did regularly, and with a total, complete resolve, forbid yourself from ever touching it, ever being involved in it again. It is forbidden. And it goes from something permitted to something forbidden because there's a powerful, powerful resolve. I think the answer for Paltiel is really quite simple. You see, the moment that Michal was given to him, he knew that she was an Eishes Ish. And at that moment, there was a tremendous sense of clarity. This is David HaMelech's wife. I can't touch her. But he also recognized that that moment of clarity might pass. So he took an action. He took the sword, smashed it down. And whoever touches that woman will be stabbed with this, because he needed to lock in that clarity. At that moment, he understood that this is out of bounds. This is forbidden. This is untouchable. But he also knew that time has a way of softening those boundaries. Time has a way of making it, I don't know, maybe it's not so forbidden, maybe a little, we're under the same roof. He, in that moment of absolute clarity, took the sword, put it in, down, and said, this is my resolve, this is my conclusion, and he locked in that clarity. And I believe that there's a major concept that we need to learn from this Chazal, and really, it's somewhat obvious, but it's not so obvious. Mark Twain is quoted as saying, quitting smoking is easy. I've done it dozens of times. And the reality is that stopping a behavior is easy. Quitting smoking is very easy. It's staying quit that's very difficult. Anyone with any resolve can easily quit smoking. What happens is a guy goes to play ball one Matzah Shabbos, he's huffing and puffing, that's it. Tosses the pack of cigarettes in the trash, and he's done, finished, quit smoking until the next morning. The alcoholic gets arrested for drunk driving, and he says, it's over, I'm done, finished. And he's drinking a week later. The overweight person goes to the doctor. The doctor says, young man, your blood pressure's off the charts. Your cholesterol's sky high. Do you want to see your children graduate 8th grade? He walks out of that room and says, that's it. No carbs. Total, absolute diet. Very shortly thereafter, he's eating the same things that he was eating before. And the question ultimately is why? Why is it that the human being will constantly have a resolve and yet go back to the same behaviors? And what I'd like to focus on a little bit now is this point. And the first point that I think a person must understand is that if you want to change a behavior that you're involved with currently, it is very, very difficult. You see, if you've never done a particular behavior, it's easy to resist it. If you never did drugs, you just make up a resolve, you decide, I'm not going to do drugs. And assuming that you're reasonably put together, assuming that you're reasonably sound of health and emotions, you'll be able to stick to it. If you've never done a behavior and it remains in the untouchable category, it's very easy to maintain that. What Palti Ben Loish understood was that he has to keep that. And he did a physical action of stabbing with the sword to keep that clear in his mind. But the battle that he was battling was one that he wasn't involved in yet. He never touched her. What would have happened had he failed once? I don't think it would have been the same fight. And I don't think that we would be reading about Paltiel ben Loish, the great tzaddik, greater than Yosef HaTzaddik. Because once you do something once and something twice or three times or four times, it's a very different battle. A very, very different battle. And before we get involved in actually applying these concepts, I think the first thing we have to understand is that you must set up gedorim. What that means is whatever I've done, whatever I've been involved in, that's okay, whatever I have to deal with, but I will not go further. I have my gedorim, I have my untouchables, I have my things that I don't do. And you have to guard those things very, very cautiously. Because no matter what level you're at now, there's a lot more to sink. And when you sink, it becomes much harder to get out. And I'll give you a few examples that I think are very, very clear. A chassan and kala must be very careful that they don't spend late nights together, very careful that when they drive, they're not alone for too long. Because the reality is that you touch once, it's very, very hard to stop. It's not so hard not to touch. And by the way, even if you're going out for a long time, and even the chassan and kala look all starry-eyed at each other, as long as they haven't touched once, it's reasonably straightforward to resist. Once they touched one time, it's a different world. To change something that you're doing already, to change a behavior that you're involved in, and especially if it's become a habit, especially if it's become something that you're accustomed to and used to, is gehenim. Very, very, very difficult. And the first understanding we have to get from Palti ben Loish is that, number one, there are gedarim. Whatever I do, I do. What I don't do, I don't do. And I will not budge. I take my sword and I put it in the ground and says, this is where I stop. I do, hypocrite. You do this, this, and that. That may be true. I'm fighting the fight. But this is my line in the sand. And on this, I will die. I will give my life. I will not budge past this point. And that resolve is very important. See, at the end of the day, we're fighting a fight. It's a battle. And the more you're in it, the deeper you're in, the more you're pulled into it, the more difficult it is to pull out. But if there are things that you don't do, and you draw your line in the sand, you stand up tall and proud and say, I do not do this. Oh, you hypocrite. You do this and that. You know, those words are the words of the sultan who would like you to believe it. But you say to him one simple thing. I do not do this. That is beyond bounds. What I do, I'm working on. What I do, I'm trying to improve on. I'm working on this. I'm speaking to Hashem. I'm asking for help. I'm focused on it. But I do not do this. This is my line in the sand. You take your sword. You place it down strong. And you stand on it. And that is the first concept we need to learn from Paltiel ben Loish, that there have to be lines in the sand. There are things that I do not do. They're out of bounds. But I think there's another point that's also very important. The reality is that there are moments of inspiration. All of us have different times when we're motivated, when we're driven, when we're like, wow, we get it. And the question is, what do you do with those moments of inspiration? Most people get inspired, very motivated, very driven, and then it passes. But if you'd like to succeed in life, one of the great secrets of any endeavor in life to be successful is that when you have that moment of inspiration, you capture it. You lock it in. What Paltiel ben Loish was doing was he felt that inspiration. He recognized this is forbidden, and he locked that in. And what that means in plain simple language is when you feel inspired, whether it was Yom Kippur or whether it be someone looking at you or whatever it might have been, and you have that moment of inspiration, you move on it. You will not cure every issue in life in that moment of inspiration. The guy who says, that's it, I'm done, taiva, finished, gone, no more, is living in a very delusional world. You cannot cure the problem with one powerful resolve, but you can make changes. It could be something as simple as trashing your smartphone, just destroying it, because if you're going to wait to return it to the store, you'll probably lose your resolve, break it, even if it costs you $500. It could be something like getting rid of a particular friend or circle of friends who pull you down. Whatever it is that you recognize as an area that pulls you down, in a moment of inspiration, if you move on it, make a decision, and at that moment, right then, move on it, you'll find that you grow, you slowly start changing, and you begin the long process of becoming in control. You will not solve this problem in one moment of excitement and resolve. you won't reach this final, that's it, I got it, and I'm done, and cure yourself, but you can take a major step forward. And I think to realistically deal with this issue at hand, what we have to understand is a few, what I would call, rules of the game. The first rule of the game is that if a human being wants to change any behavior that he's involved in already, it is very, very difficult. Not to do something that you haven't done before is simple. And again, it's worthwhile for you to go to younger friends, maybe a younger brother or someone, and tell them how difficult it's going to be, what a Gehenna it's going to be to pull yourself out. But if you haven't done it yet, it's nowhere near as difficult to remain away from it. What we're discussing is things that we're involved in, things that we're steeped in and pulling out. And this game is a very, very difficult game to play. And the first primary understanding that a person must have is that if you don't have a clearly worked out plan, you will fail. Our smoker, if he doesn't have a plan of how he's going to stop smoking, forget it. Our fellow weighing 400 pounds, if he doesn't have a very clear diet that's worked out, he will fail. And if you're looking to change any behavior that you're involved in and you don't have a clearly worked out plan, you will fail. Because like anything in life, it's not overnight and it's not quick, and you find yourself in a very, very difficult situation. The reality is that many behaviors are easier to change than this one. If you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and they tell you you can never touch another drop of alcohol again in your life, you understand. It went from permitted to absolutely, totally forbidden, and you stand on that resolve and you never allow another drop of alcohol to touch your lips again. But the problem is that with the issue that we're dealing with, it's not going to happen. Even if you're super motivated, even if you went through the greatest tshuva program in the world, and you reached the absolute depth of misery and charata, and you totally resolved, I guarantee you will not stop this issue overnight. You will not succeed in going cold turkey. And I'll explain to you why. You see, not drinking alcohol is simple enough. All you have to do is never touch a drop of alcohol again. You could look at bottles of alcohol, you look at beer ads, and you could go to a party and see people drink. As long as you know that alcohol will not touch your lips, as long as you remain strong and firm in your resolve that you will not drink anymore, you're fine. But you see, the fight that we're fighting is a bit more complicated. And I'll explain to you why. I gave the mushal before, and I want to repeat it. If a fellow gets drunk and falls down on his face and messes his whole face up, and he does it again, and he does it again. Imagine the fellow says the following, "This is terrible. I keep getting drunk and falling on my face, waking up with bruises, and I can't do this anymore." So what does he do? He finds himself the best ballet teacher he can, and he takes a ballet class. And he says, "Nah, what are you taking ballet for?" The guy says, "Simple. Every time I get drunk, I fall down and break my face. I'm going to take ballet, learn very good coordination, good balance. That way, when I get drunk, I won't fall down and break my face." Nah, don't learn ballet. Don't get drunk. You can't get drunk and not fall down on your face, no matter how good your balance is. And that is the great problem that we deal with. You see, the problem we deal with is not living with an eishes ish. It's not living or doing actions. It starts way, way before. The real battle that we fight has nothing to do with actions. It has to do with thoughts, and it has to do with things we look at. You see, the real battle is fought on a very different level. Once you're looking at things, once these images are coming up in your mind, you lost the battle. The real battleground is not looking and not letting these thoughts come into your brain. And in that way, it's vastly different than any alcoholic. because an alcoholic can think about alcohol. He can even dream about it. He can even think about how wonderful it used to be. As long as he understands that if I drink again, I'll die, he can remain firm in his commitment never to drink again. But the problem is, with this issue that we're dealing with, it's way more complex. Because the minute you start seeing things you shouldn't see, and the minute those images start coming into your brain, you become a different person. The nefesh habahami becomes excited, and you start desiring it, you start wanting it, and much like the yerk that takes over you, but it doesn't take over, it's you who now want it, you will change. Your resolve will fall away. It'll melt away like ice on a hot day. It'll just disappear. And that firm, firm, powerful resolve that I will never will melt and be gone, because you will change. And you have to understand that that's why this battle is so difficult. And because the battle isn't fought on the activity level. It's not fought on the action level. It's fought on the not looking and not thinking level. And unfortunately, the reality is that I don't know of the human being born who can say, I spent the past number of years looking and staring and ogling and thinking, and from this moment forward, it's it, I'm done. No more will I think, no more will I look at, I'm cured. And the idea of going cold turkey just doesn't work. Oh, you can forbid certain activities, and you can put your sword down in the ground and say, I will never do this again, and you might succeed. But the idea of cold turkey solving this whole problem will never help, because reality is, as long as you're looking, as long as you're thinking, you're going to become more interested, more interested, you will change, and you'll end up doing that which it is you shouldn't be doing. And for that reason, I want to focus on what the actual fight is. And let's focus on something that we're not really allowed to talk about too much. It's certainly not discussed because it's very unpopular. However, there is a full lo saseh in the Torah, a full negative prohibition in the Torah, where the Mishnah Berurah says that there is no debate. Not a single Rishon, not a single Achron, not a single Posek denies that there is a full lo saseh in the Torah called lo sasuru. Do not veer after your heart, and do not veer after your eyes. Lo sasuru acharei levavchem v'acharei einechem. Says the Mishnah Berurah in clear language, if you look at a woman for the purpose of being nene, what a beautiful woman. She's attractive. Wow. If you look at a woman for the purpose of enjoying that looking, you violated a lo saseh of the Torah. And he says, even be'etzba ketana, even at the small finger, we're not even talking looking at a part you shouldn't be looking at. If you look at a woman's finger for the purpose of enjoying, for the purpose of, it means with lust, with hunger, with appetite, you violated a lo saseh of the Torah. And this is very, very important to understand. Why does the Torah asar us from looking? The Torah obviously doesn't want us living. That's to say, don't live. Just say, don't live with an Ashazish, don't live with an Arias. Why does the Torah say, don't look? Because what happens is, when you start looking, the images get in your brain, they start percolating, they come back again and again and again, and you're gone. You're gone and it's over. And you have to understand that to fight this fight, you have to fight it at the battle level. And the battle level is right on the ground, not looking, not thinking. And understanding that every time I look at a woman for the purpose of lust, desire, if I look at her with appetite, I violated a lo saseh. I believe that that's a very educational concept that we have to bring back to our understanding. I have to recognize that the fight is fought not looking at the billboards, not looking at the ads, not looking at the pictures. When I go to the grocery store, not looking whether she's Jewish or not. She could be the frummest woman in the world, but if I look and I'm drawn and I'm attracted, bingo, I just lost. And it just violated lo saseh. And I want to point out something very, very profound. Not a one of us would eat McDonald's. Imagine passing by McDonald's. Hey, cheeseburger. Oh, yeah, come on, let's go. Not a one of us would eat crab. Not a one of us would eat pork. We don't eat trafe. We don't wear chutneys. We don't do things like that. And yet we violate this law on an ongoing, regular basis. And I think what the Mishnah Berurah is telling us is that this is just as usur, as bad as eating pork, as bad as wearing chutneys, as bad as stealing or lying, certainly much worse than chalav stam, is this lo sase. And you may say, oh my goodness, Rabbi, this is going to fill me with guilt. I'm going to be so broken. Let's first deal with reality and then we'll deal with the guilt. You see, I find it almost comical to listen to the attitudes that guys have when you start telling them that there's a love. Nah, come on, can't be. It's too big. There's no way the Torah could ask that. Mom is physically impossible. Mom, physically, but can't be. Can't really be forbidden. It's probably like a mitzvah chassidus, like, you know, some sort of thing. Hashem really can't expect me to work on this. The Mishnah Berurah is the posek achriti. And what he's saying is that no one argues. There's not a single shita in the world. You won't find litvish, chassidish, satmar. You won't find anyone who argues it is a law in the Torah, it's forbidden to look. And if you'll tell me, well, Baruch Hashem, I don't walk on the streets, I only look at magazines, I only look at billboards, and etc. Maybe, technically, you're right, you didn't violate the law in Los Asuru, but you got exactly the same machala, exactly the same disease, you got the image in your brain, and you have to understand how this fight is fought. Once the image is in the brain, it's going to plague you and come back and come back and come back. It's going to haunt you and it won't leave you. And there's only one cure, and that's not to look. And it's a very interesting thing, the way Taiva works. The more you give into it, the more you desire it. The more you give in, the more you desire it, becomes stronger and stronger. It's true that momentarily, if you give in and there's a release, that momentarily you're satisfied. But Chazal describe it like drinking salt water. If you're thirsty, I need something, and you take a big, tall glass of water right from the ocean and you drink it, for a moment there, your thirst is sated. But in a very short time, that salty feeling makes you even more thirsty than before. Any type of taiva that you give into, unless it's proper and with your wife in the right way in the right time, will make you hungrier and hungrier and bring it back more and more desire and will make it much more difficult. But the chiddush is that you don't have to be living with an ashes ish to have this problem. It's looking at the billboards, looking at the pictures, looking at the women in the street. It's every time you see one of those images, you bring it up into your brain and the desire becomes stronger, and you're making your life miserable. And there's only one cure. Stop looking, stop thinking. And it's a very interesting thing. When you stop looking and stop thinking, the images sort of weaken. It's not instantaneous, but if the image is, let's say, 100% vivid and powerful, if you don't think about it for a day, even if it comes back, it only comes back 80%, not fully, fully, powerfully vibrant. And if you don't think about it for 2 days, it comes back only 60%. And if you let it fade away, it gets weaker and weaker, and it becomes more difficult for it to come back, and more difficult, and eventually they leave you. But the key, and this is the key, is you have to stop thinking about them. And I want to share with you a yesod that I don't know that a lot of people realize. People usually say, oh, I would love not to think about this stuff. But the problem is, I can't not think about it. They just pop into my brain. I'm learning a Tosis, and bingo, she's right there. I'm working on a car. I'm fixing a car, and bingo. I don't want to think about it, but I can't help myself. I can't prevent it. If you watch very carefully, there's actually a very, very interesting timing that happens in your brain. Let's say you're working on your car or you're learning your Tosis or whatever you're doing. Suddenly, something comes not into the forefront of your brain, but somewhere along the edge, there's something. And I'd like to give a mashal. It's almost like there's a gel. Almost like, you know, like a pill comes like in this this, you know, like vitamins sometimes come in this little gel pack. This is a gel pack. Now, if you turn away right now, it won't open. But if you let it stay in front of you, it dissolves, the gel pack opens, and boom, she's right there. There is a tiny amount of time. And when that gel comes right in front of you, that gel pill is right there. And if you turn away right then, it won't open. If you let it stay, it'll dissolve, and bingo, she pops out. But if you turn away at that moment before it opens, boom, it'll disappear and won't be there. And I think this is one of the main concepts that you have to understand in terms of how you work on this. You see, if I give you the following exercise, I want you to the following. From now on in, I want you not to think of pink elephants, right? I don't want you to ever think about a pink elephant ever again. Now, what's the first thing that happens when I tell you not to think about a pink elephant? First thing you do is you imagine a pink elephant. And you see, this is why people make a mistake about how to fight this fight. You cannot not think about women. You cannot not think such thoughts. What has to happen if you want to succeed is, the minute you see that gel pack, the minute you see that sort of image sort of bothering you, wanting to come in, you have to think about other things. You have to put your brain onto something else. And you have to focus on something that you're able to pull yourself towards. And that's really the area of battle. And one of the techniques to be successful is to have things, images, scenes that you pull up at that moment and you switch to them instead of letting that gel pack open up. So that when you feel it coming, when you see it sort of gnawing at you right there, instead of letting it come, you switch. And what you switch to can be whatever works for you. And for one guy, it could be a gorgeous beach in Aruba, just white sand and blue sky, gorgeous one seagull floating away. For another guy, maybe the Swiss Alps. For another guy, it could be skiing. Whatever it may be that you have as an image, something that's interesting to you, that's appealing to you visually, graphically, that pulls you in, you have to train yourself to use it and break away from it. As I mentioned earlier, if you're married, one of the best techniques to do is to keep an image of your wife vividly in your mind so that when you're walking down the street and there's some other woman and you feel yourself pulled or attracted or whatever, you just pull up the image of your wife and you say to yourself, this is the one that Hashem gave me, and this is the one that I want, this is the one that I love, this is my wife. And gone is the other woman, gone is the issue. If you're not married, obviously that's not as easy. And the fight is more difficult. But still, the fight can be fought. How do you fight it? What you do is, you have images, you have things that you bring up, and you distract yourself. One of the most dangerous situations for Ben Torah in the 21st century is to be bored. When you're bored, you're in big trouble. Because when you're bored, your mind starts to wander, and before you know it, you're way, way down a path that you never wanted to be. And you have to be very, very busy. If you're a masmid and you could keep learning and learning and learning, matov manayim, you should keep more sederim and more sederim and more sederim. But if you're not, then make sure that you have things that you're busy with. They could be interests, they could be hobbies, they could be businesses, they could be academics, whatever appeals to you, have things that you're very, very involved in. For one guy, it could be sports. For another guy, it could be running. For another guy, it could be woodwork. Another guy could be reading. Whatever you find appealing and enjoyable, it is a very good idea to be actively involved. I was a big fan of hobbies. As a high school Rebbe, I would always encourage the guys to have hobbies. Again, if you're going to learn 18 hours a day, maybe it doesn't apply to you. But assuming that you're born in this century, and assuming you're part of the real world, and certainly if you're in high school, there's going to be a lot of downtime, a lot of time that's not going to be spent in front of the Gemara. So I would encourage the guys to stay busy. If it's karate, if it's boxing, if it's drums, if it's football, whatever it may be, get involved in something, because boredom is your greatest enemy. When you're bored, you're lazy, you're lethargic, whatever, the gel pack comes in front of you, and oh, whatever, let me just look a little bit. And before you know, boom, she's right there, and you're starting to desire, and you need, and you're hungry, and you've changed. And not only have you changed that right now you might do something you shouldn't do, more than that, you strengthened that desire. You now made it come up stronger the next time. You now made it easier to come up the next time. The fight is to distance the images as much as you can, so that initially, if it was coming 10 times an hour, you slow it down to 8, then you slow it down to 6, and then once an hour, and then once every 2-3 hours. And the more distance you put between the images, the weaker they become, the less frequently they come, and you become much more a master of your thoughts, what's going on in your brain. Now, obviously, what you look at is going to have a major impact on what you think about. And Mayasa ben Valiechta, if you walk down Fifth Avenue midday in the middle of the summer, you are going to be in big trouble, because I don't know of the tzaddik who can walk down Fifth Avenue in the middle of the summer and not see things that will enter his brain. But you see, that's the point. Don't do it. Figure out a way not to do it. Figure out a way to solve that. And I'll share with you on a personal level, one of the greatest brachas that Hashem gave me as a matana, I believe, is a chesed gomer. Until I entered Yeshiva Beis Medrash, I had perfect eyesight. My eyesight was perfect. When I turned 19, 20, all of a sudden my eyesight went and I needed glasses. Strange thing, you talk to an optometrist, very rare. If you need glasses as a kid, you need glasses. If not, that you have good eyesight. And that I couldn't see at about 19 years of age. I couldn't see distances. And I needed glasses. And it was the greatest bracha, because it solved all of my problems. When I walked in the street, I took my glasses off. I couldn't see a thing. Mamish anes. And you have to recognize that if you're a human being, you have to know your strengths, know your weaknesses, and you cannot walk out in the street and hope that you're not going to see things that are going to get into your brain, that are going to affect you, and you have to find a solution. The solution might be, if you can take off your glasses, take off your glasses. If you don't wear glasses, borrow a friend's glasses and put them on. You're not going to solve all the problems in life, because the reality is there are times when, despite your best effort, you're still going to get caught. You still have to drive. And I remember as a bachur, many a time when I'd be driving, get out of my sight, I have to drive, but I don't want to see you. And it's a battle. And it's not an easy battle. But you have to recognize where the battle's fought. The first line of defense is not looking. Not looking because it's a lo sasei, but not looking because what you look at, if you're a healthy young male, you're going to desire it. Unless you're strange, unless there's something wrong with you, when you see an attractive young woman, you're going to desire her. Good morning. That's the way Hashem created us. And there's no tefiyah against you for being the way Hashem created you. And if you can't get out of the situation, it's onus mayasa ben v'liyachta, okay, you can't get out of it. But if you can, run like you're running from a fire, because it's going to destroy your simchas achayim, it's going to destroy your life, it's going to make you miserable. Listen to the addict as he describes what it's like to be chained to the bottle. Listen to the coke addict describes what it's like to smoke crack cocaine, to need it, desperately need it. And unfortunately, that's what a Baal Taiva is. And these desires never allow you to be happy, never allow you to be in control. They'll constantly plague you and plague you. And the fight starts at the not looking. And you have to devise all types of methods and all types of ways not to see, not to look. And each person has his own design. For one guy, it may not be the street. It may be the computer, the internet. It may be the smartphone. Having a internet access today without a very strong filter is literally holding a revolver with live ammunition in it and playing Russian roulette. It's only a question of time. Now, a week from now, a month from now, when you're going to end up in a site or a scene or an image that you didn't want to be at, you really didn't want to see, but it's there, it's in your brain, and it will cause you untold amount of pain and torture. I think what Paltiel Ben Loish teaches us is a tremendous yesod. If you haven't done something, it's reasonably easy to resist it, if you know how. What you have to do is you have to strengthen your resolve. You have to stick your sword in the ground and say, I will not. And regardless where you're at, we have to have our gedorim that are untouchable, areas of things that we don't do, and we stand on them. That's our line in the sand. But the real battle isn't on that front. The real battle is changing the things that we've been doing till now. Because the real battle in Taiva is not the acting out. If you go to the 12-step programs, which might not be a bad idea, they'll tell you the problem is acting out. Well, I have news for you. When you're dealing with Taiva, the problem is not acting out. That's one of the manifestations. The problem is many steps earlier. The problem is what you look at, what you think about, because if you think you're going to solve this problem cold turkey by never again will I act out in such and such way, I'm afraid to tell you, you're living in a very, very delusional world. For the record, most people who go on diets to lose weight and are very motivated and go on very, very good diets, oh, they lose weight and then they gain it again. You know the guy who lost 150 pounds? Yeah, he lost 10 pounds and gained 20. Lost another 10, then gained another 20. Lost another 10, gained another 20. When he's all done his diet, he lost 150 pounds. But he weighs 450 pounds now. 5% of dieters are successful in losing and keeping the weight off. And that's assuming they have a good diet program. And the reason is because change is very, very difficult. And even if you have a good program, you have to know how to work it. And the reality is that you and I are not going to solve our problems instantaneously, change every midah. I'm going to get rid of my anger and my arrogance and my selfishness in a heartbeat. I'm just going to decide not to do it anymore, to be gone. That's not the way Hashem created us. But Hashem did give us the tools to work and the tools to progress. And you have to know how to fight the fight. And the first episode you have to know is that you're not going to win this battle overnight. It's a long and steady challenge. And I'll share with you something that Rabbi Dvoritz, Rosh Yeshiva of Rochester, used to say often. If you take a professional baseball player, let's take a good hitter. A world-class hitter is going to have a batting average of 350, right? 350 is considered world-class. In fact, 300 is not bad. And that's in the major leagues making millions of dollars a year. So let's understand what that means. Imagine we have our hitter. He's a guy who's a professional. For the past 20 years, he's worked on his stance, worked on his timing, worked on his swing. He's got this down to a science. And he gets up to bat in front of hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people watching on TV, and he's being paid all types of money. And 7 times out of 10, he strikes out. It's not that he doesn't hit a home run every single time. If he gets on base, that's considered a hit. How many times from that he's standing up at the plate, how many times does he make it onto base? The answer is if he's a great hitter, 0.350, which means out of 10, 3.5 times. If he's a 0.300 average hitter, so out of 10 times at bat, 3 times he gets on the base. The rest of the time, the 70% of the time, he doesn't make it. He strikes out, pops out, but he fails. 7 out of 10 times the guy failed, but he didn't fail at hitting a home run. He failed at just getting on base. What a loser. Just quit. Quit. You're a total loser. And yet, these guys don't quit. They're paid millions of dollars. Millions of dollars, and they're considered world champion. Every kid wears their t-shirt, their name on their own t-shirt because, wow, if I could get Barry Bonds' name on my, wow, if I get his signature's autographed, they're considered champions. And Rabbi Dvoritz's point was you have to know how to count. You see, a lot of people think that success means if you're a home run hitter, every time you get the bat, that's a champion. But in the real world, that's not how it works. And it's not how things are counted. And the real fight is fought in the thinking part of your brain. And the real fight is fought when that gel cap comes in front of you and you don't open it. And if you win 3 out of 10 times, you're a superstar. If 3 out of 10 times that gel cap comes to you and you say, no, I'm turning to something else. whether it be drumming or an image or whatever, I'm out of here. You're considered a world-class athlete, and you're batting 300. You're astonishing. And you know why? Because when you start batting 300, you start separating the images. They start coming less frequently, less intensely. You start changing. You start growing. As long as you don't let the Satan get into your brain. Look, you loser. You're working on this issue. You're working so hard. And 70% of the time, you fail, you loser. 70% of the time when that gel cap comes in front of your brain, you open it up. You're a hypocrite. You're a loser. You're worthless. Give it up. It's not for you. And those words are the words of the Satan. And those words will destroy you in the world to come and in this world. But if you know how to count and you know how to play the game, you know that the game is played by very small incremental improvements. And that means if you're 3 times out of 10 successful and you don't open that gel cap, 3 times out of 10 you don't look when you're walking down the street, you're accomplishing worlds. And I want to share with you a flip side to the Chazal that a lot of people don't know, and the Satan does not want you to know. There's one piece of Gemara that the Satan does not want to let you know, but I want you to look it up after. It's in Makos Daf Chof Gimel Amud Beis. Asher Yaseh Osam Ha'adam V'Chai Behem. That which a man shall do, and he shall live with them. This is talking about Arias. And right after the parsha of Arias, it uses the Chai Behem. Says the Gemara, called Yoshev Lo Over Avera. Whoever sits and doesn't commit an Avera, Nosan L'Schar Ka'osem Mitzvah. They give him reward as if he's doing a mitzvah. And you look in the Rishonim, you look in Rashi, you'll see what that means is, if you have a desire and you resist, you're given reward as if you did a mitzvah. And what that means in plain, simple language is, if you're going out in the street and you know that there are women and whatever, and you sure are tempted to look and you don't, you are hugely successful. You're racking up mitzvah after mitzvah after mitzvah that are so powerful, so valuable, that for eternity they're yours. And I'll share with you why the Satan doesn't want to let you know that Gemara. Because he's going to tell you you're a loser anyway. You're wasting your time. Don't you understand? Yes, you won't look now. Yes, you won't look for an hour. But eventually you're going to look. You're going to do it anyway. Give it up. And what you say to the Satan is, sorry, I learned the Gemara. And the Gemara seems to argue with all due respect. You're a malach, but you don't write the Gemara. And Gemara says, if you walk in the street and you don't look once, you don't look twice, you don't look 3 times, you're given schar as if you did a tremendous mitzvah equivalent to what the aveira would have been, and you didn't look, that's yours for eternity. That not looking is your mitzvah, and you rack it up moment after moment, time after time, every time you don't look, every moment you don't look, you're given reward. And here's the next step that the Satan doesn't want to let you know. That means even if the next minute you do look. Let's imagine you're heading down the street. You don't look, you don't look, you don't look, you don't look. Finally you look. Oh, a crash. I'm dead. My whole work, everything I worked on is gone. Wrong. What you worked on, you worked on. Every time you resisted, you're given reward. And every time you resisted, you get stronger because of it. And you failed. 3 up, 1 down. Okay. I'm way ahead of the game. And what this Chazal tells us is that not only doesn't Hashem put us in situations that we can't resist, Hashem gives us situations that allow us to rack up reward that's unimaginable. Do you know what it means if you walk down Fifth Avenue and you keep your eyes down, or you take your glasses off, or you somehow don't look? Every single woman who's pretty and young and attractive and normally you have gawked at and ogled and desired, and you don't look, every single one is mitzvah after mitzvah after mitzvah after mitzvah. You can come back after a short walk and say, wow, I accomplished the world. Now, don't go be too wise over here. Again, Chazal tell us, al yamid atzmo adam b'makom nesayin, don't ever put yourself in a makom nesayin. Don't go out testing yourself to rack up rewards. You may fail. It's not the way Hashem wants you to do it. But the reality is that if you're in such a situation, and you resist, every time you resist, you're given reward, and the given reward, You're becoming more strong. You're becoming more powerful. You're winning the fight. And Hashem is happy. And this is one more thing the Sultan doesn't want to let you know. You know, Hashem's really angry with you. Look at you. You're a bum. You're a worthless creep. You do that avera. You know how big that avera is? You know how many times the Torah warns about Arias? How many times the Torah warns about not looking? How could you say Shema twice a day and say those very words that you're going to violate? You're a nothing, worthless slime. Guess who is the author of those words? A Musa Sefer? Uh-uh. A Gemara? Uh-uh. The Sultan? Uh-huh. You see, those words are destructive, damaging words that are sheker. Hashem does not put you in an assignment you can't be omed. And if you fail an assignment, Hashem isn't angry at you. Is Hashem saddened that unfortunately you're not growing and accomplishing? Maybe. But Hashem understands. Hashem recognizes. I didn't ask to be born into this generation. I didn't ask for taiva. I didn't ask to be bombarded with this stuff, yom and valayla. And as long as a guy is fighting the fight and winning, and even if you're just winning some, Hashem is happy because you're growing, you're accomplishing, you're heading up, and eventually, imitz Hashem, with a lot of help, you'll cure this problem. You'll be a different human being. But again, the key is to know where the fight is. The key is to know how to keep score. And the key is to know that every time you resist, even if 10 minutes later you look, that one time you resist, you gain schar, you're given reward. And you have to come up with all types of tricks and all types of kunzim. Again, from personal life, I became a ganz fine bucky in women's shoes. When I was a bacher in yeshiva, for Alter Bassem, I had to go home. And my parents davened in the Young Israel Kugan Hills, and I couldn't not go there. And when the Young Israel piles out, all the people pile out into the street in front, and it's a major malu. So I would stand by my, you know, by my parents. But invariably, different women would come by, younger girls, older, whatever, you know, the back and forth. I became a tremendous student of women's shoes. I could tell you which style, which heel, what color. Why? Because I wasn't a tzaddik. And I recognized that I wasn't a tzaddik. And I wasn't interested in all of the trouble that I was going to have if I didn't keep my eyes where they needed to be. But you see, that's how you fight the fight. Not with gvura. I'll be strong, I'll look and I won't be, care. You have to fight it with wisdom. You have to understand that I'm not a Gibor Chayil. I'm not Yosef HaTzadik. I'm not Paltiel Ben Loish. I'm a weak, frail human being, but I'm going to fight this fight with wisdom, with strategy. I'm going to study the human being. Why do we spend so much time in this series discussing Nefesh HaBahami, Nefesh HaSichli, the different parts, imagination? Because I have to become a student of human nature. Because I am a human, and I have to understand myself, and I have to become wise to myself, and I have to become wise to what works and what doesn't work, and what actually affects me, how it does and how it doesn't. Because the only way you're going to win this war is by being very, very strategic. You have to be very driven, very focused. You have to ask for Siyat HaShemai, you have to beg Hashem for help. But to fight the fight, you have to be very, very wise, you have to understand yourself. You have to understand the tricks of the Sultan. You have to understand where the battles are fought. And you have to know what strategies are going to help you and which are going to destroy you. And I have two more points. One point is why this man is called Paltiel. Gemara in Sanhedrin told us that his name was Palti. He was given the name Paltiel because HaKadosh Baruch Hu saved him. Now, isn't that strange? This man fought a fight. This man battled a battle. And this man is called a Gibor greater than Yosef HaTzadik. Do you understand what Yosef fought for an entire year, fighting and fighting and fighting? This man is even greater. So what do you mean Hashem saved him? Hashem didn't save him, he saved him. He fought the fight with wisdom. He put the sword down. He conquered himself. He mastered himself. So what do you mean Hashem saved him? He saved him. And this is the Yesod. 95% of the victory goes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. 5% is your effort. Mrs. Sharon, when describing the Sultan, says he's Ish Melchama Umlubim Army Milis. He's a warrior, devious, deceitful, strategic. But he's a Malach. And lulei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if it weren't for Hashem, EF should be impossible for any human being to win against him, even if he's only allowed a certain amount of control, even if he's only allowed out of the box a certain extent. No human being would be able to face him. He's brilliant. He's a fighter. He's a malach. He's on the job 24/7. He never gets tired, never takes coffee breaks. He's plotting and thinking and dreaming and understanding you far better than you understand you. And if you want to be so sophisticated and say, I don't believe him, Malachim, Rabbi, I can't get into the angel stuff. Well, wake up and understand that this is reality. Wake up and understand that this is what's really going on. And if you don't want to accept it, the next time you fail and you say to yourself, how could it, what happened? It's time to start waking up and realizing what's going on. And you know why he's called Paltiel? Because he fought with wisdom, with strength, with gvura. And because of that, he got Siyata Deshmaya. And because of that, Hashem helped him. He took one step forward and Hashem pushed from behind. He opened that tiny small opening and Hashem opened it up huge. He put in 5% of the fight and Hashem put in 95% of the fight. And gentlemen, that's the key to success. To recognize what Hashem wants from me. Hashem doesn't want to torture me. Hashem doesn't want to make my life miserable. Hashem loves me. Hashem wants me to succeed. But Hashem wants me to stand up and fight. And if I stand up and fight and I beg and I ask Hashem to please help, Hashem helps and the fight becomes easier and easier and you win more and you win more and eventually you vanquish this. It's not a 6-month battle and it may not be a 10-year battle. It may take 20 years, but eventually you win and eventually the whole thing disappears. But it's oftentimes a very long bit of battle. But you have to understand that not only isn't Hashem angry, Hashem wants you to succeed, Hashem is with you. And if you put in the little effort, Hashem puts in the rest. The 95% is from Hashem, provided you do your part. But there's one more step that I think is very, very significant to understand. What happened to Michal and what happened to Paltiel? Well, Shaul was killed. And Mephibosheth, the son of Shaul, rebelled, but in the end, David won out. Vayishlach David Malachim, David sent messengers, El Ishbosheth, to Mephibosheth, ben Shaul, saying, Tana es Ishti es Michal, give me my wife, give me the woman I'm married to. And Vayishlach Ishbosheth, Mephibosheth took this woman, Michal, and started bringing her to David. Vayelech ita isha, her husband went with her. And you see, Mephibosheth was acting as the king, and as the king was bringing the daughter of Shaul to David, was bringing Michal, but the husband of Michal, namely Paltiel, was going with. Haloch ubochar, he's walking and crying achareha. He's crying. And as Mephibosheth is taking Michal back to David, Paltiel is crying bitter tears. Ad Bahurim, until he got to a certain point, Vayomer Elav Avner, Avner said to him, Lech, Shuv, go, return, you have to stop here. So as Michal is being taken back to her real husband David, and this other man who was with her all this time is walking along with her, and he's crying and crying. And Rashi says, why is he crying? Why he's walking, I don't know, but why is he crying? Says Rashi, al mitzvah ha'aleches mimenu, because of the mitzvah that he's now losing. Shekal osam hashanim, because all of those years, na'etz cherev beino lebeino b'mita, all of those years that he was with her, he kept that sword between them in the bed, v'lo nichshol ba, and he wasn't nichshol. You know why he was crying? Because he recognized that his best friend is leaving him. What do you mean, my best friend? The nesayon. I mean, the Nisayan was killing you, was torturing you every night. Every night you had to look at the sword. Every night you had to strengthen yourself. Every night you had to say, I want, but I don't. I do, but I don't. But in that moment of clarity, he recognized what he accomplished in that Nisayan. He became greater than Boaz, greater than Yosef. He became one of the champions of history. But why? Because he had the Nisayan. And if you don't have the Nisayan, you can't grow. And if there weren't billboards, and there wasn't Wi-Fi, and there weren't all of the devices and issues and things that are going on in our world today, we would never be what we could be. In our generation, we can become astonishingly great. We read about Slobodka Yeshiva. We read about yeshivas that have 500 blot entrance exams. And we can't ever imagine being on that madrega. A 13-year-old, 14-year-old taking a 500 blot entrance exam. We can't even imagine being on their level. And whilst that's true, I'd like to share with you that they could never imagine being on our level. Do you know what it means to be in the United States of America, or in Europe, or in Israel, or wherever you are, to be constantly bombarded with desire and needs and beautiful women always there? What was the Nisayan in Slobodka? There was no Nisayan. The women, if they saw them in baggy clothes, the Polish peasants, whatever they might have been, bag ladies, they were in that Dalit Kosei based Medrash. They were pure and they were secure, locked away. If you took one of them and put them into our world today, I don't want to know what would happen. And this is one of the key points that a person has to know. Not only doesn't Hashem torture us, not only doesn't Hashem want us to be miserable, Hashem wants us to grow, to accomplish, and we're given one of the greatest opportunities imaginable. And the fact that we're constantly bombarded, the fact that it's constantly there, the fact that we're fighting the fight. And if we bat even 300, we're a world-class champion. But you have to know how to count. You have to know the value of a Nisayan. You have to know where the fight is fought, and you have to know what Hashem expects from you. Hashem grant us the wisdom, the ability to put this into practice.